Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. We are going to begin with State versus Schwind. Before we start on this case, I wanted to let you all know that the chair next to me, she has withdrawn from participation in this case, so she won't be on the bench today, and she's not participating in anything further in regard to the case. So with that brief announcement, are you prepared to begin? Please do.
Just a brief word. I notice in the audience is a former justice of the High Court in the state of Massachusetts, Justice Geraldine Hines. So I'm going to try to sit up and make sure I speak clearly, lest I get criticized by my colleagues from Massachusetts. But welcome this morning.
Yeah, thank you very much. I had no idea you were here. Welcome from me as well. Please begin.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Andrew Walter. I represent the appellant, Dennis Schwind. We stated many points in our brief, but this morning I hope to discuss three main points, which is first, the inherent power that we're asking the court to recognize today is a power that has been recognized historically in Wisconsin going back to the era of the common law. Then, on the second point, that Section 973.093D does not and cannot affect the court's inherent power in this area. And finally, that the cause standard is the standard that will produce the most reasonable results that are consistent with the fair administration of justice. On the first topic, as I said, this is a power that is historically recognized by the courts. In Hayes, the court started its analysis by noting that under the common law recognized the power of a court to modify its judgment and its sentence in a criminal case within limitations. So Hayes wasn't the first to recognize this authority to modify a sentence. What Hayes did was address the limits.
Counsel, with respect to sentencing, that's an inherent authority itself that the court has always had. Is that correct?
Yes.
Right. So that goes back to the time when there were common law crimes, common law sentences.
Yes, that's correct.
With probation, is that something that the court has always had the inherent authority to impose?
It is not. Probation is created by the legislature. The legislature creates the probation opportunity, and then the court's inherent authority is to impose. That is what the court's authority is, whether it's sentencing or probation. The court's authority is one of the court, the judiciary is the one that imposes the sentence or the probation.
And if the authority to impose probation is of a statutory origin, does it also follow then that our ability to address probation is governed by the statutes?
The courts are limited to the minimums and maximums that the legislature has created, whether it's sentencing or probation. The court cannot modify a probation term to go below the minimum that's allowable, and that would be the same in sentencing. I don't believe that the fact that sentencing initially was something that courts had the power to do before legislatures created sentences has a real impact here, because at the time Hayes recognized this power, the common law had already been abolished at that point. Mm-hmm. So And subsequently, as I noted in my brief, the court has actually applied that same new factor type analysis in at least one probation case. I hope that answers your question, Your Honor.
Thank you. It's certainly approaching it. So if the legislature could have decided not to give us the authority to impose probation, we wouldn't have been able to do that ourselves anyway. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So if the legislature says you may impose probation, but here's how it's done, here's the restrictions on your authority, is that legitimate for the legislature to do?
The legislature, as I said, the legislature can set the limits in terms of minimums and maximums. I don't think the legislature can interfere with the court's discretion to impose one of the sentences that the legislature, or one of the dispositions that the legislature has provided for.
Right. So, but if it said, for example, if it said, here are the circumstances under which you can change probation after it's ordered, does the legislature have the authority to restrict us in that way?
I don't think it does, and there's a few reasons I would say that. And this gets into whether the statute here that we're talking about, 973.093D, affects the court's inherent power. It cannot affect the court's inherent power because the court cannot fairly administer justice without, at minimum, the ability to correct when it has imposed either probation or a sentence based on an error, based on inaccurate information at the time it made the decision, or based on the lack of information that's essential to that decision of what to impose.
Right. We're not talking about a clerical error in this case, right?
Right. What I'm talking about at this point is a new factor.
Yeah. So we're outside the realm of the court's inherent authority to make sure that its judgments are accurate. Right. So now we're talking about we've imposed probation, and now we want to substantively modify it. So where's the inherent authority come from to do that?
It is the court's duty, or the inherent authority comes from the Constitution. And inherent authorities are those that are necessary for the court. In this context, they're those that are necessary for the court to effectively and efficiently perform its constitutionally and legislatively mandated functions. And one of those functions is imposing a sentence. And so it has to impose justice fairly when it imposes a sentence. So in the new factor realm, we're saying that when a court imposes probation based on inaccurate information, not that the judgment is inaccurate, but the court made its decision based on inaccurate information or based on a lack of knowing information that was essential to that determination, then the fair administration of justice, both for the defendant and for the public, requires that the court be able to modify it, that a sentence that is based on inaccurate information is not the fair administration of justice. It also does not protect a defendant's due process right to be sentenced based on accurate information. So that in that context, that's where the inherent power is one way that the inherent power is necessary.
How, if at all, is your argument different than Justice Abrahamson's dissent in Doughty?
I don't know that it is different, other than Justice Abrahamson there was...
The dissent.
Was the dissent, but the majority did not say that there is no inherent power. The majority just said we're not going to address it. We're going to handle this case solely based on statutory, whether there's statutory authority, because I think in that case, the defendant had not raised the court's inherent authority in the circuit court.
So your argument stated differently is that we should adopt the dissent in Doughty.
Yes, I have. I think in terms of I don't know that there's any disagreements with the dissent, but I think there are additions to kind of fill in how this would actually work in terms of the standard. So under a cause standard, I don't think the court just says the standard is one of cause and that's it. It's what does that mean? Well, the standard is tailored toward what is the purpose of the court's function when it imposes probation. And the court's function when it imposes probation is to effectuate the purpose of the probation statute, which is rehabilitation and the protection of the public.
Doesn't the cause standard have a different foundation than court's inherent authority, which you're arguing for us to employ?
It's certainly different than the sentence modification standard. I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor, as far as the foundation.
Well, I was responding to your statement that the court shouldn't just say it can be modified for cause and that's the end of it. And so my question really was wanting you to explain what you meant a little bit
sure.
more.
Sure. So when we say cause, it's directed to rehabilitation and the protection of the public. So has the person been rehabilitated? In other words, is leaving this person on probation having a court's order that may have made sense at the time it was entered, now wasting the taxpayers' money and limited supervisory resources on someone who no longer needs supervision? And also, so cause would be whether there's cause considering whether the person has been rehabilitated and whether there's a need for continuing supervision to protect the public.
And that's how you would frame the standard. If you were to frame it for us, you would say we wouldn't just say cause, you would say cause related to rehabilitation and protection of the public.
Right. It could be whether there's cause and the court should consider whether the person has been rehabilitated and whether there's a need for continuing supervision, or just whether the person has been rehabilitated and whether there's a need for continuing supervision to protect
because
the public.
Because looking at the dissent that Justice Ann Walsh Bradley wrote in Doughty, her concern, and I don't know if it still is that cause is too broad.
I understand that. and so the difficulty is flexibility is essential when we're dealing with probation because probation is a continuing process. It's a continuing rehabilitation process. So you don't want to create a standard that limits too much the discretion of a circuit court to respond to what is necessary in any particular situation. And in the end, that's what we're talking about is the discretion of the circuit courts. So in a certain sense, it's difficult to deal with the floodgates argument without limiting the court's ability to be flexible in each individual case. I do think there are some limitations that would limit that floodgates concern. Number one, the court cannot do through a modification what it did not have discretion to do at the time of imposing the sentence. So no person would be able to apply for a modification until they've served at least the minimum of what the statute allows for probation. The principle there being the court does not have discretion to do on modification what it didn't have discretion to do at the time of sentencing.
Should we be concerned at all that in many of these cases, what you're asking us to give the circuit courts the discretion to do under inherent authority is to make another judgment in a case where they didn't preside over the trial, they didn't preside over the plea hearing, if there was one, and a different judge, it sounds to me like you're asking, your client is asking for another judge to make a different decision. Basically, it's getting a second kick at the cat, and what makes me uncomfortable about that possibility is that we have the legislature which is the body that created probation in this state in the first place, setting out six parameters that, when I read them, I see those as legislative policy choices, and you're asking us to recognize the inherent authority of the judiciary to say, you know what, we don't like those policy choices, we're going to impose our own. And one that I focus on in particular that has relevance to this case is that the legislature gives courts the authority to modify probation unless the probationer is required to register as a sex offender. And your client is required to register as a sex offender. So there's policy implications there, aren't there?
Yes, I understand that. I think there's two issues there with your question. The first is the idea of a different judge ruling on the modification than the judge that imposed the sentence. That is a problem that is common not just in modifications, but oftentimes the judge that imposes the sentence is not the judge that took the plea or heard the trial. What we do know is that a person is not going to be able to shop for a judge. They're not going to be able to choose who their judge is. But the issue of a different judge hearing the modification motion is something that is a part of every issue in this state that you often don't get the same judge from start to finish of a case.
What I guess I'd like to hear from you are what limiting principles we put on this, because this could open a can of worms, not just in the context of probation, but we could have litigants coming to us in other contexts where the statutes give judges discretion in family law cases, in children's court, CHIPS cases, termination of parental rights. And what are the boundaries of a court's inherent authority? Because it sounds to me like your argument is that we have the inherent authority to do almost anything and override legislative policy choices, and I'm uncomfortable with that.
Right. Well, that's not the argument that I'm making. First of all, I can't really speak to anything outside the criminal context. That's outside of my expertise. But I can say that I think the new factor or sentence modification standard is applicable to almost every other situation. I can't think of a situation other than probation where that is not the limitation. The reason that probation is different is because probation has very different goals than sentencing. Probation is about rehabilitation. And so it doesn't make sense to limit it with a standard, to limit modification or the court's inherent authority with a standard that does not allow a court to consider the person's rehabilitation.
Does it matter here that the judge initially said, I will review probation later on? I mean, is that a potential limitation? Does that fact matter at all?
I think that that could be a new factor, that there's been that the judge was either mistaken about the law, which depending on the court's decision in this case, maybe the sentencing judge was not mistaken. Maybe he does have that power. But if the court did not have the power to review after 15 years, and part of the sentence itself is, or part of the judgment itself is, the court is open to considering this after 15 years, and it did not have that power, then it based its sentence on an error.
Okay, that was one way to look at it. I was thinking more like, if we're worried about how far this authority goes, if we have situations where judges at sentencing say something like, I'll review probation in 15 years, is that something that the court has the inherent authority to make that statement and then to review it in 15 years, but perhaps if they don't make the statement, it's something that we don't want judges just picking up and taking these modifications. I don't know if you want to extend it that far, but is that a possible limitation?
That, just so I make sure I understand, that the limitation would be unless a judge said that I will consider this after 15
years?
Well,
stemming from your argument that was part of the sentence, right? Part of the sentence was, I'm going to review this in 15 years to make sure that I still think it's appropriate for you to, for me to have said that you should get 30 years of probation, right? Or whatever, I don't remember the exact amount. But so that's part of their sentence, and the courts have inherent authority over their, even though probation's not technically a sentence, but they have inherent authority over their sentences, part of which in this case was, I'm reviewing this in 15 years.
That is correct. I think I don't think they have that in sentence modification because that requires the new factor. But I do think that a court does have the inherent authority when imposing probation to say I will review this in 15 years.
Counsel, how would that interact with what we said in State versus where we said that once the defendant has been charged with a crime, tried, defended, convicted, sentenced, and gone through an appeal if desired, the litigation is over and the judicial process has ended. And we further said, whether a convicted defendant is sentenced to prison or the circuit court imposes probation, the adversary system has terminated and the administrative process vested in the executive branch of the government directed to the correctional and rehabilitative processes of the parole and probation system has been substituted in its place. How does that interact with your suggestion just now that a court could retain the authority to change the term of probation when he first imposes it?
Your Honor, that statement in Horn was a response to the argument in Horn was that when a court placed somebody on probation, that was a stay. And so the court was saying, no, it's not a stay. The case is closed when the court imposes probation. It's not a stay, and thus the court, it's not a stay. So in probation, unlike a sentence, there is no, I think there's a difference between whether the case is closed and whether it's final. In probation, there is no finality until the person is discharged.
And what is your basis for saying that?
The statute allows the person to remove themselves from probation at any time for any reason. The statute allows the court to modify the terms and conditions of probation at any time for cause.
Right, but that's a statutory provision.
It is. Yeah. But when we're talking about whether there can be finality in probation, the reality is finality is impossible in probation until somebody is discharged.
Well, it's a question of whether we have the whether as an inherent matter, we continue to have jurisdiction over the sentence or not, right? So if we continue to have, if our inherent authority is, we always have jurisdiction over that sentence, so we can go back and modify it for whatever reason that we happen to think might be a good enough reason, that's one thing. But if the sentence is, or judgment of probation is final, then we can only go back and change that according to the terms that are granted us by the legislature, right?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor.
Why not?
I think the court always has the authority to make any actions regarding the imposition of probation when it is necessary for the court to fulfill its function of fair administration of justice.
Right. I know that's your position. But what I'm trying to figure out, though, is what is the justification for that? So when we talk about sentencing, one of the reasons that we require a new factor is because what we're trying to get at is, did we make a mistake? And we always have the authority to correct our mistakes, right? But in probation, we're not dealing, what you're asking for is not a correction of a mistake. You're asking for a reassessment of, was this the right amount of time to accomplish whatever purpose we were trying to accomplish? That's different than correcting a mistake, isn't it?
Well, there's two things on that point. Number one, we are asking for the ability to correct mistakes. The court has never recognized the new factor analysis applies to a probationary term. So first, at minimum, we're asking the court to recognize that the same standard at minimum, those same justifications for modifying a sentence apply to modification of probation.
Right. Even if we were to accept that, that doesn't apply to this case, right? You're not saying there was a mistake made in the probation order.
Not that there was a mistake made in the probation order. I do think there's an issue of whether the judges, if the court says that the judge did not have the authority to review the probation after 15 years, there is an issue of whether that the judge's error about the law, about the judge's authority under the law, whether that constitutes a new factor. To your original question, we are saying at minimum, I mean, ultimately this comes down to what is necessary for the court to fairly administer justice in when it imposes either a sentence or probation. That is where the court gets its inherent authority, and that authority comes from the Constitution. What is necessary to fairly administer justice is at minimum that it be able to correct errors, and also that when we talk about the cause standard, what we're saying is two things. Number one, this court in the Stenkliff decision said that the power to impose includes the power to modify. And then, in addition to that, that the fair administration of justice also requires the court to consider the fact whether a probationary term that it thought was the correct probationary term at the time it imposed it, it turns out the person has rehabilitated much more quickly. And now the court's order is responsible for wasting the public's resources on supervising somebody that doesn't need to be supervised anymore, that doesn't present a danger to the public because they're rehabilitated. And so I see my time is up, if I can just complete that point.
Yes, please.
Okay. That the court needs that ability so that it can fairly administer justice for the public, that it is not wasting the public's resources. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Michael Sanders, representing the state of Wisconsin. Schwind is seeking early discharge from probation, but he's not seeking that discharge under the law which controls early discharge from this, WSSTAT 973093D. He cannot be discharged early under the statute because he is a registered sex offender. He therefore can never get a discharge under that law. So he's asking this court to hold that the court can do under its inherent authority what it cannot do under the law, which is discharge him early even though he is a registered sex offender.
We dealt with that issue regarding the statutory authority in Downey 2. As I recall, not specifically the point, but the statute itself, and left for another day the issue of inherent authority vis-a-vis modification, termination of probation. Am I correct, or do you see it differently from that?
Not exactly, I don't think, because...
Oh, no, don't tell me this.
Because in between the time that the decision was made in the appellate court, and this court accepted the case, and the briefing was done, they changed the statute.
Yes, they changed the statute, and what was the purpose of the change of that statute?
Well, up until that point, they did not have the same type of a way for a discharge to occur, and that statute gave that authority to the court with the condition that it started in the department, who had to make a determination, And then if they made that, which is the, which essentially is the for-cause standard, that the, that a discharge early would advance rehabilitation and protect society. If that happened, and you also met six criteria, then the court could discharge a person early.
So the purpose essentially was to give the court the ability to do review of the executive branch's determination on probation vis-a-vis this particular area. Before that, there was no statutory authority for
right.
that. Okay. And yet the problem arose, as I understand it, that the first subsection, which requires the executive to petition, was seldom implemented, so the court, under statutory authority, it was argued, was being limited in its review role, and therefore the inherent authority issue then developed. Is that your understanding, or is it different? This is strike two, if you say different.
I don't recall in the case there any talk about how the department would not do it or wasn't doing it. And I know that they, at this point, are. They do petition on, I don't want to say on a routine basis, but they do. I've got the stats, actually, on how often they do.
One final area of inquiry, as I understand your opposing counsel's argument, you have, of course, the new factor test for sentence modification, but this... the new factor test for sentence modification doesn't allow for consideration of rehabilitation, which is one of the essential purposes, one of the two purposes of probation, rehabilitation of the defendant. And so your opposing counsel is advancing, putting some meat on this for-cause argument. As I understand it, the meat is circumscribing the for-cause inquiry in this way, that the for-cause has to go to one of the two purposes of probation, rehabilitation or protection of the public. What's wrong with that?
Well, that would that is only going to come into play if a court has inherent authority. So what's wrong with it is that since a court does not have it, it's not easy to make up a standard that would apply if it did, because it doesn't have it. There was nothing in the Constitution about this. It's completely a creation of the legislature, and they could, I think, if they wanted, they could say from this point forward we're not going to even have it. So there isn't authority to do something that they only have the authority. There isn't authority to do this, to discharge a person early, when the only reason that they have authority to impose it is because of the law. Not of their own authority or their own authority under the Constitution.
If the legislature did away with probation and the probationary scheme as an option, do you think if I were sitting as a circuit court judge in Marathon County, I couldn't say to the defendant, John Smith, who came in front of me, okay, I'm going to hold this case open, and I want you to come to me and report, as I did, by the way, report every Monday morning or every other Monday morning that you went and got your medications and you did this and such, you know, and that you're seeking employment and such, and really impose that as a condition, regardless, irrespective of the statutory scheme of probation. Think I can't do that?
I have not thought about that, what would happen if there were no probation, but since there is, and it was made by the legislature, they had the ability restrict and limit what a court can do with it, and they have. And they've said that if you want to give a person a discharge early, here's how it works. And here are the statutory criteria. If you don't meet them, you can't be discharged early. And he can't meet them. So on that, and it makes sense, because what they said is that you essentially first have to meet the four cause standard, in that the department, who is the group who should know if you are rehabilitated, can say he actually is. And then after that, you also have to meet all of the other things, which is you have to serve half your term, you have to have paid all the money you might owe, you have to meet all the rules and conditions, and you can't be a sex offender. So you have to do all of those things, which are, again, a limitation on the ability to discharge a person under the four-cause standard that the defendant is asking for. You could have a person who meets none of those. The department hasn't said he is rehabilitated. He hasn't served half his term. He hasn't paid back his money. He hasn't complied with the rules and conditions. He is a sex offender who has had to register. And the court can just say, yeah, I think we should shorten his term. So there is no, as you said in your opinion, in the last case, this is an amorphous standard that isn't going to provide a court with any guidance.
It seems to me that maybe when I indicated that the four-cause standard seemed amorphous, that begs the question, four-cause standard, what does it mean? What kind of cause do you need? Mm-hmm. That they're now saying, well, this is what you need. You need information that goes to the essence of probation, a new factor that would, if you want to use that term rather than information, that focuses on the two purposes of probation, primarily the rehabilitative needs, in contrast to the new factors of sentencing. I think that's what they're attempting to do anyway. So whether or not that sufficiently circumscribes it for you is another question.
No.
What would they have to do to circumscribe it?
Well, I didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
What would they have to do to circumscribe it sufficiently? Keep the factors as now exist under the statute?
I think that'd be a good first step. I don't know why a person would be able to get a discharge from a court without any input from the department if it couldn't meet the standards that the legislature has set for the department to make the first determinations and then send it to the court. So at least it has to be that if you haven't met all of those standards, so that it's not a matter of the department having, you know, who didn't want to do it for some reason, even though you actually met the standards. It's not that. He can't meet any of this. Well, that's not true. He can't meet the one standard. So there's nothing there. But this is just a way to try to avoid the whole thing and have the court just kind of do it because it wants to, even though it's not in the best place to determine if he actually has been rehabilitated. One more thing that comes up because of the statute is that when the department asks the court to do a discharge early, it also requires the court to inform victims so that they have a right to be heard. If a court can do it under a four-cause standard, I don't know that that's going to happen. And they may not have any say as to whether this guy is going to be discharged early. Not this guy, but anyone is going to be discharged early.
I just want to clarify, if you were done.
Yes, thank you.
It isn't just the one standard. There's six standards under the statute. I don't think he met five of them.
True.
I just wanted the record to be
I didn't
clear
mean
on
one. I just didn't want to say all, because I, as far as I know, he has paid his fees and restitution.
And I think that's the only one he's satisfied. The department
I think that's true.
The department hasn't petitioned. He didn't complete 50% of his period of probation. He violated the conditions of his probation early in the probation term. From what I read in the record, he therefore did not satisfy all rules and conditions that were set by the department, and he is required to register as a sex offender.
I think that's all right, except that the first time he asked the court was in 2014, and at that point, I don't think he had been in for half of his term. Now I think he has asked again, and he may have been in for half of his term, but he hasn't met all of the other ones you just referred to.
Let me go back to something that you said earlier about what the court shouldn't be the one to be able to do this at this point. It's about the legislature. I mean, you acknowledge that when someone comes in front of the court in the first place, the court decides what happens to them.
Sure.
So the court could have never put him on probation, could have put him on probation for 5 years, 10 years, and there's no legislative other than the caps, right, and the potentially the minimums in certain cases.
Sure.
So it is a working together, right? This isn't a realm that falls directly within the legislative function or directly within the court function.
Sure.
So how then can the legislature say that the court can't do this? And I don't know that that's what that statute does say, because how does the legislature infringe on the court's authority the same way the court can't infringe on the legislature's authority? I mean, it is a push and pull.
Well, if a court can do this on its own with no input from the executive branch, what I think the court is doing is infringing on the executive branch.
Even though the court could at the beginning, with no input from anyone, decide not to put him on probation or to only put him on probation.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
So, I mean, the court is charged with making these decisions every day. Maybe it'd be great to have more information. It's always better. But that doesn't mean that the court isn't still charged with making these types of decisions.
Right. And at the time that it has to impose a sentence or an alternative such as this, that is the court's role. But once he's in once he has been placed on probation, he's in the control of the executive branch and the department. And so here, at least, it makes sense, I think, to say that the first determination, which is rehabilitation, would be made by the department, who is in the best place to determine if he has been rehabilitated. And then after that, there are some other criteria, but the decision at the end is for the court. Because if the department says he has been rehabilitated, he meets all of these six criteria, so we're going to ask the court to do it. The court can say no. It
just
still
can't
has authority.
Work the other way around.
I didn't hear you.
It just can't work the other way around. The court can't say it if the department doesn't recommend it.
The way I think it would work is that if they both want him to be discharged early, he is. But if one party or two parties don't want him discharged early, he isn't going to be. So if there is an authority of the court that doesn't come from the legislature, it's shared, and here it's shared. They both have to agree, or he isn't going to be discharged early. Okay, I'm not sure if I should keep talking or sit down. I was expecting some more questions.
You have to exercise some judgment here.
Yeah, I'm not good at that sometimes, but, there are some things that I don't, well, I guess a couple things that I want to touch on. There are forms on the court website that deal with this, with how the department gets files a petition and what the court looks at in deciding a petition, and those essentially track the law and the statute. If it's up to the court on its own, there are no standards that I can find anywhere it seems as though the court can just do it, which, again, doesn't really make a lot of sense when there are some criteria which it should follow. One thing that I wanted to bring up in case anyone has looked, there is a department rule about this, and the rule that's on the books right now is about to be changed. It's DOC 32817, and the rule is very out of date. And
very what? I didn't
out of date. The rule as it stands right now, essentially, it has been in place since 2013. But it was first in place in 2010, and it said that it was the department and not the court who had the authority to discharge a person early. They then started to change that rule in 2010. Then the law passed, 973D, which made it the court's job at the end to determine if there was going to be a discharge early. However, the rule which they had started to change, that changed once the statute had been put in place. So the rule as it stands right now is nowhere close to what the law says, and says that it's the department who has the authority, not the court. However, they are trying to change that right now. It's in front of the Assembly and Senate right now. And what they want to change it to is you can get a discharge early as in accordance with 973093D to make it as clear as possible that the department has no authority on this on its own. It's the court, and it's the way the statute works.
Do you make any distinction between, in your arguments, between inherent power and inherent authority?
I have not. I hadn't considered that. One last thing, then, if there aren't going to be any more questions, is there is also an offender handbook, which apparently you get when you are put on probation. And
are you asking these things that you're referring to, mm-hmm. kind of doing a little housekeeping
sure.
here at the end? Are you asking us to take judicial notice of these, or are these in the record? Or
they are not in the record. They are on the department website, so I think you could take judicial notice if you want to. I'm just kind of explaining that the way this all works, I think, is quite clear. And when you start this, you have a handbook which says there is such a thing as early discharge, and if you want to get it, it's first up to your agent, and then here's the criteria. It goes to the court, and you can't do it if you're a sex offender. And it's all extremely clear, I think, that that's how this works, and I think everybody who starts this knows it. And there is no authority of the court to try to bypass the statute and do what the statute says it can't do. If there are no further questions?
I've got one.
Oh. Well, thank you.
Do we have a separation of powers issue here? Because I'm looking at the Horn decision and the Henley decision, and I'm going to paraphrase instead of reading from the cases.
Sure.
And I guess I'd like defense counsel to address this as well. These cases basically stand for the proposition that once the judiciary's role is complete, sentence is passed, probation is imposed, then the case is turned over to the executive branch to administer the probation. So is the judiciary intruding if it says, well, wait a second, we want to take another look? And in particular, it's the Henley decision that says, you know, while defendants deserve a fair hearing, they don't deserve unlimited hearings, and the fair administration of justice is not a license for courts unconstrained by express statutory authority to do whatever they think is fair at any given point in time. But my specific question relates to whether we have a separation of powers issue here if the judiciary steps in where the executive branch is now in control.
I I think, yes, that this is now something for the executive, but the way that the statute reads, there is still the authority for the court, but not to do it, that there would be an I didn't start that very well. I think there would be a separation issue if the court has authority to do this without first having the input from the department. So if it were to have this authority, yes, I think it would. If it does a discharge under the law, then I don't think it does, because they have said, we're going to make this a shared power. You can both do this. It starts with the executive. It ends with the court. So the court could still veto a decision by the department, but I don't think the department minds that that's the case and that the authority at the end is for the court.
Well, if the court can still have authority at the end, then isn't it still administering justice? I mean, this isn't like put him on probation, court totally done, now executive branch, right? There's a means for which it to come back to the court. So it's a shared authority as far as separation of powers go. As the court has authority over all kinds of things that are in front of them, the case doesn't go away, correct?
Sure.
So, I mean, the separation of powers issue really, it's shared, right?
I think it's shared, yeah.
But what does it do to
under the statute, it's shared.
What does it do to the rule of law if that judicial power is constrained only by the bounds of what a court deems to be fair, regardless of what the legislature says and regardless of what the executive branch says?
I just want to be clear. Do you mean if the court were to say that a court has inherent authority?
Correct.
Then I don't think it's a shared power anymore, and the court is going to have say to completely bypass the executive branch, which is supposed to have some authority here.
Would it be accurate to look at it this way? Once we get done with our judicial function and the judgment goes over to the executive to execute, the only way that it comes back to us is along the lines of authority established by statute.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Other than if there's a new factor, other than if, I mean, there's all kinds of exceptions, right? What if it gets appealed? What if, right? It doesn't just, the courts are not out of the picture.
They're not out of the picture if it has imposed a sentence, but this isn't a sentence. It's a probation, which is not a constitutionally mandated thing for the court to do. It is created by the legislature, which hasn't limited the authority of a court. It instead gave some authority to the court to impose probation.
To impose a statutory form of probation.
Sure. Yes. Has that answered your question? You too. Has that answered your question since you started?
My questions are answered.
I just want to make sure.
From you so far. Yes, thank you.
Right. If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Very good. Rebuttal.
Regarding whether to defer to the legislature here, I want to make one thing clear of why the court has to find an inherent power here, and that is if the court finds there is no inherent power, that the legislature entirely controls this area, the courts will not be able to correct the errors that they made when they imposed probation. Under the statute, if there's no inherent authority, even if a court placed a person on probation based on incorrect information, the court would not be able to make a modification unless the Department of Corrections filed a petition, unless the person was not a sex offender, unless the person had served 50% of their time. The executive cannot have a veto on the judiciary's power to correct its own mistakes. So it is essential at minimum for that the court have inherent authority. When we're talking about this, it is a shared power, and the court should not have an undue interference with the legislature, but it should also protect the powers that the Constitution gives to the judiciary.
Well, counsel, I'm wondering what's the point of all the limitations contained in 973.0? If we just have inherent authority to govern probation anyway.
Well, two things on that, Your Honor. Number one, I don't think they do limit a court's inherent authority. I don't think that's what the legislature intended to do, and I can tell you why.
Well, let's start with, let's just pick something out of the hat. Sub 2, sub A, sub 1. Except as provided in sub 2, for any of the following misdemeanors, probation shall be not less than 6 months, nor more than 2 years. Do we have to recognize those limitations?
Yes, because that is the legislature has the power to create the sentences or dispositions.
Okay, but if we have inherent authority to do probation and our job is to do justice, what if we decide that justice requires a 3-month probation?
That would be an undue interference with the legislative power, whereas correcting an error is not.
But why? Why is that an undue influence with the legislature?
Because what the court said in Horn is that as in sentencing, the legislature creates probation, the court imposes according to the limits the legislature has provided, and the executive administers probation.
Right. So now we look at the rest of 973.09 and we see that sub 3A gives the court authority to extend the period of probation, right?
And under limited, subject to the power of the Department of Corrections to first file the petition.
Do we have to observe that limitation?
No. I think you can't observe that limitation because that would mean that a court has no power to correct an error that it made in imposing probation.
We're not talking about errors in probation. What we're talking about here is changing the court's judgment on how much probation is necessary. That's not a question of error. That's a question of exercise of discretion, right?
Well, I don't agree with that. I think there can be an error at that time. For example, if the court decides that 10 years of probation is necessary, but bases that decision on information that turns out was incorrect. The court has to have the ability then to go back and to modify that judgment.
That's not what we're talking about here. Your case is talking about, I think my guy's rehabilitated and therefore probation should end, right?
We're talking about both here.
But the actual case is not a case of error. You're not identifying anything the court did when it imposed probation and said, that piece of information right there was wrong.
Right, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So in this case, you're just saying, I think the court should just re-exercise its discretion. Yeah?
That it has the power to do that because it is necessary for the fair administration.
So you would say that the legislature does not have the authority to say, courts, you can extend probation, but you can't restrict it.
Right, and I don't think that the courts, I think that's exactly right.
Okay, and is that because of separation of powers violation?
It is, because the court's role is to impose.
All right. And then I don't understand then why the period would also not be a violation of the separation of powers. What are you doing telling me how much probation we can impose as a judicial act of discretion? How come we don't get to just say, well, that's what we think, and I don't care what the legislature happens to think of on that subject?
Because it is basically with the two situations we're talking about, the court has to follow what the legislature sets. I see my time is up. If I can continue.
You can conclude your thought.
Thank you. The court, when it sets probation, is one issue, that it has to follow the legislature's rules. But now we're talking about whether the court needs to modify its own order for the administration of justice, not to deviate from minimums and maximums, but to ensure that it has administered justice fairly. And on the same point, the statute, there's a similar statute in sentencing where a court is allowed to modify sentences 973.195, I think it is. The court has found that that doesn't affect the court's inherent power, that the legislative grant of statutory authority is not a limitation on the court's inherent authority. And so I think when we're talking about the statute and whether to defer to the legislature to conclude, I don't think that that's what the legislature intended. There's no support for the argument that because they granted the court a statutory authority, it means that they intended to restrict any other authority that the court had. And number two, that no matter, even if they did, they cannot restrict the court's ability to correct its own errors.
Thank you. Thank you both for very good briefs, a very interesting issue, and good oral argument. We're going to take a little bit of a break now so that another set of attorneys can come in and people can exit and enter the courtroom. We are adjourned.